the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. It is February 16th. It is my objective to run a meeting that proceeds at a rather brisk pace today. Mr. McSpadden, would you please introduce our first item?
Certainly, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. We have two items today, both work sessions. We will need a quorum to take votes on both items. The other items that were canceled, we will try to bring back at a later time. The first item we have up is the Department of Environmental Quality to speak on their environmental data management system project. The second item is the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority to give an update on their one integrated eligibility, Medicaid eligibility project. As both of these projects are under Dr. Cummings' oversight, we're going to switch places and allow you to move into work session for those discussions.
Sound good?
So now I'm opening this work session right here.
Yes.
I'm opening a work session on Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Cummings, please present the item for us.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Cummings. I'm with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Today, we're having a Department of Environmental Quality come in and there to provide the committee with an overview of their Environmental Data Management System, EDMS, project and the funding request, general fund and bonding authority they've made to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to continue the EDMS modernization project work required to obtain OSCIO Stage Gate 3 endorsement, tentatively scheduled for November of 2018, and to partially fund the next stage of actual system design and development beyond Stage Gate 3. Would the agency please come up and please introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me today Angel Gillette, who's our project manager for the Environmental Data Management System. And we also have with us Daryl Landrum, who is with the Chief Information Officer and who has been very involved in this project as well. We appeared before this body back during the 2017 session to provide information to the committee about the EDMS project, and the 2017 legislature did appropriate funds for us to get between Stage Gate 1 and Stage Gate 2 on this effort. We just received Stage Gate 2 approval from the CIO's office, thank you, and are before you today to talk about going from Stage Gate 2 to Stage Gate 3. Very briefly, the reason for this project and the purpose of this project is to deal with something I think you hear about quite often, legacy systems. For DEQ in particular, the department evolved around legacy programs around air, water, and land quality, and the information systems associated with those programs grew up in a siloed fashion as well. So for the past, between Stage Gate 1 and Stage Gate 2, we have been going through business analysis and some early process improvement work, particularly in our water quality program and our air quality program, but some others as well, to identify what the current state is of our systems and our business processes, and also to look at the desired future condition. This is a slide just showing some recent information on what some of the problem driving this project is. Some of you may be aware we just had a Secretary of State audit completed on our air quality program that shows a significant and growing backlog in our permit renewal work. And there was a third-party external review of our water program a year earlier, which showed similar problems there. Part of resolving these issues is process improvement within the agency and making better use of the funds that the legislature appropriates to us. But another part is fixing our data management systems, and that is the purpose of EDMS. Right now, we have over 130 legacy systems. This is a listing of a portion of those 130 systems, and again, they're clustered in siloed fashion around our air, water, and land programs. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Angel Gillette.
Thank you. Co-chairs Riley and other members of the committee, for the record, once again, my name is Angel Gillette, and I'm an EDMS project manager. So as Richard mentioned, part of this project is standardizing processes across air, land, and water. This project will improve DEQ's services to the public. It will increase efficiency. The time to issue permits will decrease, and the permit backlog will also decrease as a result. This slide shows where we are now, and as Director Whitman mentioned, we just received Stagegate 2 endorsement earlier this week. And so it shows here that we plan to achieve Stagegate 3 at the end of this year. And after that, we will be working on the core system build. So the core system will need to be scalable, modular, and configurable. Once it's fully operational, DEQ's strategy is to bring on additional modules. The funding request is shown by this slide here. So the core system build that I just talked about is through December 2020 and is estimated at $7.5 million. So the funding request is a $5 million bond and a $2.5 million general fund. The 10-year total cost of ownership is estimated at $14.3 million. So keeping in mind that we are only at Stagegate 2 at this juncture, and that estimate will be further defined when we get to Stagegate 3. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Nierman.
What's the source of the bonds? How do you pay the bonds back?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Nierman, these are general obligation bonds that are funded by general fund dollars. That's so a portion of the general fund request is to pay the interest on the bonds during this biennium.
Yes, Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other day we realized there's over 90 computer system upgrades going on. We need to start integrating these systems. I mean, I don't know how other states do it, but it seems like we're continually doing computer systems. The failure rate's fairly exceptional, and it must be a great boon for the bidders of it to have this literally millions and hundreds of millions of dollars we spend on a regular basis. It seems like we need to start integrating and see if we can use we're continually doing the same thing, and even seeing the legacy systems that are completely outdated and no software, no support. But I just want to point out that what's the fix for this so we don't continually have this workload, which is really hard on departments to change computer systems and upgrades. So I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, Representative.
So, thank you. So a couple of things that are kind of priorities to me, seeing as you're kind of early in the process. So I'll just chip these on the green and you can do with them what you want. So the first one is that one of the weaknesses I think that's endemic in some of these state data systems is the ability to share data outside of the system. And that problem is twofold. One is to share data with other agencies, and the other one is to share data with the public. So you're going to create a bunch of data here, and I think that in a large part, this is going to be a public-facing application.
That's right.
So maybe that part's not quite so critical. But I think someday the Department of Agriculture or the help me out, I'm not like a DEQ guy or whatever, but
some Department of Forestry.
Is going to want some of your data, and you're going to want some of their data. And so it'd be nice to set that up. And so in the year 2021, you're going to come back to this committee, and with the Department of Agriculture is going to want data. And the right answer is going to be, we have that set up. Representative Nierman, we did that way back in 2018, and it's all set up, and it's ready to go. And we'll be sending the credentials over to the Department of Forestry this afternoon. and we don't need any new personnel or any hardware or anything like that. So I hope you do that. One other thing, if I could, and I'll just really be real quick, is when you do have a bunch of data that's going to be hosted, and you have kind of two choices to make. One would be at the state data center, and the other one would be in a third-party cloud. And I just hope that you weigh both of those options there. And I know there's reasons to pick one over the other. So that's the end of my comments.
Thank you.
Is there anything you'd like to point out to us with regard to that?
Very briefly, Co-Chair Nathanson and Representative Nierman, a couple of things. One, in terms of the sharing of data, a good example of that is our water quality data. We spend a fair amount of resource on monitoring water quality now. Much of that data are not available to other agencies. Part of the purpose here is to put that in a system where we can share that not only with other state agencies, but with local government and with the public as well. So that very much is part of the purpose here. And then in terms of state data center, we have not been a major user of the state data center. We are evaluating whether that makes sense right now, but certainly we're going to be looking at the full range of alternatives for that. So, but appreciate it. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more.
I'm going to interject and then call on you. Thank you, Representative Nierman, for asking the question. And that's pretty cool. Two right answers, huh? with regard to the first point about data sharing. I'm very glad that you are proactively working on that and acknowledging it. And that's a really good thing, because we just passed a bill in 2017 saying you're going to have to start sharing your data anyway when you haven't been, not just your department, but that we expect that of all departments.
Understood.
That there's no more proprietary departmental stuff, that mm-hmm. we should pay for something once and not seven times if seven agencies need the same piece of information. Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $5 million bond, what's the term on it?
The Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator DeBoer, I don't know the answer to that. We'll have to find the answer to that and get back to you, unless...
it's fine to get back to me.
Yeah, we'll
the question is, it 5-year, 10-year, 15-year? I just want to know.
I think it is longer than shorter, Senator, but we'll get you an answer.
Good, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? LFO, do you have a recommendation?
Yes, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. Based upon the LFO's analysis and review of the EDMS's projects, planning actions taken to date, LFO recommends that the JCLIMT acknowledge receipt of the agency's report, adopt LFO's detailed recommendations to the agency as contained within the detailed LFO analysis posted on OLIS, and recommend approval of the agency's resource request, assuming the funding, spending authority, and personnel resources are made available to the agency by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Is there a motion to accept the LFO recommendations?
You need it from our side?
It doesn't matter.
So I'd make a motion to accept the LFO recommendations.
Thank you very much. Is there discussion on the motion? Objections? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here. Good luck. Go forth and do good things. I'm closing that work session and opening a work session on Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, the One Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, the Department of Human Services, DHS, and Oregon Health Authority, OHA, are here today in response to a 2017 legislative request that they return to the 2018 legislature to jointly report on the status of the One Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project, IE/ME, with evidence that the project is back on track, and to provide additional evidence that the agencies are ready and able to successfully complete the project. Within their report, the agencies will also provide a summary of their revised baseline go-forward plan and funding needs. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tony Black. I'm the Independent Project Director for the Integrated Eligibility Project on behalf of DHS and OHA. And I'm here to provide an update on the project. But before I do that, I would just like to mention that in December of this, a couple months ago in December, we celebrated the second anniversary of the One System, or the Magi Medicaid system in production. And I wanted to let you know that we have served about 850,000 people through that system so far. And we have an opportunity right now to expand on that success and incorporate into that system the non-Magi Medicaid portion of that program, as well as a supplemental nutrition assistance program, or food stamps, temporary assistance for needy families, including domestic violence survivors, and the employment-related daycare system. So that's what our project is about, is to capitalize on that investment and build that system out. So I thought I would share that with you. As far as the
Earth Day to everybody.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
We did celebrate that.
Good.
It was good. Getting right into the mechanics of the project and the update on the project, I was here in November to talk about the 2017 legislative instructions. More specifically, in May of last year, we received 26 instructions from the committee. And then in September of last year, an additional four. We've been working on those in unison with the LFO and the CIO's office. Back in November, when I was here to report on that, we had completed six of those items. 14 were in progress and six were ongoing. We now have one left. It happens to be the same one that you asked about, Representative Nathanson, back in November, which is our test plan. On the right there, it just shows the percentage of those 26 items from May. And so out of the 76% that we can address, 3% is left of those. So we've made great progress on those. And this was a slide that I had presented in November. The blue bars were the only thing on his charts back then. It just a representative comparison between November and now. A couple of things that I wanted to point out on while we're on this slide is that number four up here was an independent revalidation of schedule and budget, and I will move through my slides pretty quickly so I can turn the podium over to our State Chief Information Officer to introduce a special guest today to talk about that assessment. Number five up here was to provide an integrated project schedule that reflects project rebaseline, which we have completed, and the project was officially rebaselined on the 12th of January. We have renegotiated the system integrator and quality assurance contract since then and have received federal approval from both the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services and from the Food and Nutrition Services on both of those amendments. We have updated all of our Stage Gate 3 documents, a couple of the assessments that were completed, an architectural assessment, a legacy system documentation system, and then the scope and or schedule and budget assessment. So in the September, the four that were identified for the September session are complete, and I won't get into those. I do want to say that we'll be serving with the new system over 25% of Oregon's most vulnerable population. So I want everybody to understand that we and the project team will take this very seriously. Get just a little bit of background on terms of how this project has changed over time from a schedule and budget perspective. Back in December of 2015 was when we received Stage Gate 2 endorsement from the CIO's office. At the time, this was a $126 million request, understanding that we were a long ways from being able to refine those numbers in terms of what we knew and what we were going to learn. In July of 2016 is when we received Stage Gate 3 endorsement to commence execution of the project. The budget numbers were updated at that time. The project was still due for completion by December of 2018. That was also the time when we expected the enhanced federal funding, or the 87 exception, to expire, and that is still the case today. Then in this last year, during the budget process for the 17-19 biennium, there was an updated scope, schedule, and budget brought to this committee with what we knew then, and it reflected an extension of the project out to July of 2019. It was an estimated biennial budget of $195 million. We are projecting that we will underspend that budget by $30 million, $165 million, and I'll talk about the reasons here on this next slide. As you can see, the project now, as of the project rebaseline and the amendments to the contracts being solidified, we have extended the project out till July of 2020. We will be complete with the implementation. We have no request of this committee for the rest of this biennium other than your continued support, but I wanted to forearm you with some information that we will be talking about in May and September of this year, as well as early next year, around a 1921 budget ask. I won't go into all of the changes that drove the schedule change there. I'll talk a little bit about it when we get to the schedule, in terms of some of the extensions and timelines around testing and pilot and implementation. This slide is just kind of summarizes that budget as best we can, 15-17 based on actuals, 17-19 on projected actuals, and then what we're expecting to be back to talk to you about for the 1921 biennium. It shows that in the project total, including the first year of M&O, that we will have spent almost $388 million, and a little over $300 million of that in federal funds, $58 million in bonds, and a little over $18 million in general fund. That's our estimates at this point. This is our revised baseline schedule.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. Could you back up one slide? Where it says 311.5 federal, the next two lines are state. Is that right?
Yes.
The bonding at the state level, and then general fund to support that. So with what amount of money you add those two together, what's the ratio of leveraging federal money?
If I'm remembering correctly, Co-Chair Nathanson, it's about 78% federal match. I would have to do the math on those numbers there, but one thing I did look at before I came over here is post December of 2018, when that enhanced funding runs out, what will be our match at that point? Uh-huh. Because it does play into the 1921 conversation. We're looking at about 66%.
So the more we had gotten done before the match rate changes, the better.
That's correct.
Thank you.
A couple of things to point out on this that were part of the rebaseline project. You see that we have in the middle of the chart there, well, I guess first of all, that we are nearly complete with design. We are in development. We have data conversion that we're working on right now. We have 5 data conversion mock runs. We have extended the system integration testing that our system integrator is doing. We've extended the timeout a little bit on our user acceptance testing and our pilot. And then we have down at the bottom right there, 3 wave rollouts across the state, starting with our pilot counties, which is Jackson and Josephine counties. And then there's a month stabilization period between each of those 3 waves. So by July of 2020, we will have rolled out to the state, across the state, I should say. This is a project dashboard that we're using now to help us stay on schedule. And it's broke down by the tracks that we have identified within the project. You can see on the left there that we are 40% complete with this project as we stand today. These slides here are the legislative instructions from last year. They're included in the slide deck for reference. And with that, if there are no questions, I would request that our state chief information come up here and talk about assessments that the state CIO's office did, as well as the guest that he brought that has completed one of these assessments.
Thank you. And as they're on their way up, I note that we do have two distinguished department heads with us. Are they
yes.
participating?
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Just briefly, Pat and I, the first time we appeared in front of you was about 9 days into our tenure as directors of DHS and OHA. At the same time, we had a new project director for this project. Fair Works Park Storage, Director of Department of Human Services, and
Pat Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority.
Yes. So you had asked us at the time what our confidence level was at the project, and we couldn't really answer that. We just wanted to tell you before we turn it over to our state chief information officer that our confidence level has significantly increased, and I'll turn it over to Pat so he can reaffirm or deny that.
I completely concur. This is a project that concerned me greatly when I first started, and if pressed, would have had to confess a fairly low confidence level. I think the work that's been done over the intervening 6 months or so has significantly improved the status of this project. The oversight and tasks that we've been assigned by LFO have been extremely helpful. I think you'll hear good information from the assessments, and I'm now highly confident in the revised scope and schedule of the project.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. When I became more directly involved, let's say, in this project in September of 2017, I had some concerns about specifically around scope, schedule, and budget. Was the scope appropriate?
Oh, just that.
Yes, ma'am. Nothing more than that. Was the scope inclusive enough? Were there things fundamentally missing from the scope at the time? The legacy systems had not been incorporated into the scope. Was the schedule realistic? Was it too aggressive? Was it being driven by the deadlines of A87 requirements and things that made it? And was the baseline or the new schedule really realistic for this to be accomplished within? And finally, was the budget appropriate? So seems like, Tony had gone through from 120 to 334. I was concerned, and was this an appropriate amount? Was this commensurate with other states that have gone through this process? Was this a realistic budget estimate? It seems like all these projects run about $300 million through them. So but I was no expert in that. And then finally, What were the gotchas on the program or the risks on the program right now? And really, were there too many that we were seeing, or were there not enough that we had, and were we missing something? So we brought Gartner in to do an assessment of the project, and I'm going to introduce Frank and Hamid now, or have them introduce themselves, I guess, to go through and step us through their findings. They had started this last fall and aggressively ran through it, and they have a summation for you that they'd like to present, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, while the presenters are coming up to the dais, wanted to remind you that the detailed Gartner report is posted on OLIS. It's a very lengthy report, but should provide any detail that you might need.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Nathanson and committee. My name is Frank Petrus. I'm the senior managing partner that heads up Gartner's Public Sector Health and Human Services practice. Our group at Gartner, the only work we do is in the space of the public sector and health and human services initiatives, such as what you're undertaking here in the state.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hamid Nouri. I'm part of our practice for Health and Human Services within Gartner. I've been working with Frank for the last 10 years exclusively in Health and Human Services projects. And I was involved leading our technical evaluation of the project, as well as the overall soundness of the approach and the risks associated with the project. So I'll be chiming in as appropriate during our discussion today.
We'll go briefly through the background. I think that you all are aware of the background and the call that you made to have a third-party objective review of the scope, schedule, and budget. That was all. Not to contradict the chief information officer, but we actually started in December.
So late fall.
Late fall. It was an extremely accelerated process. One of the things I want to say clearly, I've been working in the public sector, health and human services. I probably shouldn't say this, but I will, since 1966. And I come from the program policy side. I used to be director of children and family services in New York State and worked in state government for 25 years and now for 26 years as a consultant. I've seen a lot of challenging projects and projects that have been troubled and projects that have failed, even here in your state and other states. And we have done forensic assessments on about 17 of the troubled projects in our country. The one thing that I want to say about the assessment we did here was the forthcomingness and the transparency of everyone that we worked with, from executive leadership to your staff person, Dr. Cummings, to the stakeholders that are on the project. No one tried to hide anything. No one made it difficult for us to access documentation or information. Even before we began digging into the discovery documents or conducting interviews, that was a message to us. We have done assessments when that kind of transparency was not evident and was not the standard operating procedures for conducting an assessment. And considering the scrutiny and the level of oversight that your team here in the state has, we were very impressed with everyone's commitment to have this third-party objective assessment to be thorough and to be accurate, and they were very forthcoming to help us do that. And I think that's something you should be very proud of your team in the state. So we did the call to come to you with what are our findings, what have we seen, and also we're comparing you to other states. We have worked on several states that Deloitte has been involved in. Some of that information we cannot directly attribute to other states, but in an aggregate form, we were able to take a look at where is this state compared to where other states are as a clear benchmark. Are you on the right path? Are the signs there that tell us that this has a high probability of succeeding? And I'll give you the punchline up front. Yes, the signs are there. We walk away from this engagement working with you and your people, including the legislative staff that we worked with, very confident that all the signs are pointing in the right direction and nothing is being hidden from you or from your federal partners. The goals of the project was really to raise the level of confidence by the thoroughness and objectivity of the assessment that we were able to conduct in a very short period of time. We did that first by project initiation and discovery, and I will say that this project is blessed with documentation. I forgot how many hundreds, 180 plus documents that we looked at, spreadsheets that we looked at, narratives, PowerPoints, requirements documents, contract materials, memorandums, etc. We then conducted focused interviews with stakeholders, including your vendors. Your vendors that are doing QA and IV&V, independent validation and verification, as well as your systems integrator, as well as executive leadership, project management from Tony Black on to his team. So we walked around this elephant as the Hindu proverb goes, blind men went out to look at the elephant and one thought it was a fire hose because they felt the trunk, the other felt it was a rope because they felt the tail, and one felt it was a palm tree because they felt the ear. We walked all the way around to really get the idea of the elephant or the donkey to make sure that we had a clear picture of this initiative. And from there, we did a detailed analysis, and we provided a summary report, an assessment. We had review, not necessarily validation. We will validate because we're the objective third party. But we wanted to make sure of two things that we wanted from your team. One, were we inaccurate in any of the information that we documented? Did we put a 3 when it should have been a 2? And we wanted to make sure accuracy. The second thing, when we made statements, was it clear? Could they understand what we were saying, what we were pointing to, what we were recommending? We got substantial feedback from your team around accuracy and clarity. If there were challenges around the recommendations that we were making, that was our responsibility to finalize the recommendations. And one thing that I saw was that when we completed the full report that you have a copy of, around 140 pages, typically we would see in some assessments we've done like this where the state would have a management response letter. We were pretty pleased to see that the state said, no, there's no need for a management response letter. What you captured, what you provided as your analysis, what you identified as priorities and recommendations are acceptable to us, and we don't need a management response letter. So the document you have has been embraced and seen by your team that's going to move forward with these recommendations as recommendations they agree with and are confident they can execute on. Conclusions. I'll go quickly through these. Scope, schedule, and budget. All of the tasks, all of the activities, all of the identification and allocation of resources, people, dollar, time, are sufficient to do the task. You have captured all them. You've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's for the scope and schedule of the budget and that leads to the budget for the initiative. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't areas where resources need to be enhanced or resources that need to be brought on that are currently in process. We took that all into consideration to basically say you are scope, schedule, and budget on the right path. And at this point in the life cycle of the project, or I would say program, because there's multiple projects, you're moving in the right direction. The second thing in our conclusion is your decision, and this is a very critical decision, to say that you will take a transfer system from Kentucky. And I could go into greater detail on this and why we walk away with this, because transfer systems aren't always successful. Every state does the work differently. You know, TANF is TANF and SNAP is SNAP, and you go through, you know, LHIP and child care, but every state has a different flavor as they align themselves in compliance with federal rules. You did the fit gap analysis and you did the functional design document to say the Benefine solution from Kentucky and the underlying .NET technology upon which it has been built is something that will fit well here. The other thing is you made a commitment to, as you modernize your eligibility business processes through your eligibility transformation effort, that you will align yourself with the best practices that have been manifested in Kentucky for Benefine. That is also reflective of best practices for eligibility and enrollment for public assistance and other human services in other states, aligned with ASFA, the American Public Human Services Association, 21st Century Transformation of Health and Human Services. That will be important as you go forward, that if you're going to make any changes in your business model that are not aligned with the fit gap analysis and the functional design document, that will have an impact on scope, schedule, and budget. That doesn't mean you shouldn't make those changes. What it means is that the executives should make conscious decisions when it will be appropriate as you move forward to design, develop, and implementation to make those changes. And are there trade-offs that can be made in other areas of the program that can help compensate for the impact of those changes? The budget that you have identified, both for the legacy readiness to ensure that the legacy systems that need to synchronize with the new system, and the budget that you have for the design, development, implementation work with your systems integrator, are not only reasonable, we find them at the low end of what we've experienced in other states. So as we looked at the DDI work for eligibility enrollment, for all of the components from one
to one IEME and look at that total budget for DDI, you're at the lower end of what we've seen in other states. When we take a look at the estimation methodology that has been employed by your team for what is necessary for legacy readiness, we think that with the contingency, even if it's going to take a little longer, cost a little bit more, you've built that into your budget. So you've got that contingency built in, and you're at the lower threshold for DDI, or design, development, implementation work. So in both of those areas, we have a high level of confidence. Unless something extraordinary happens that we did not see and anticipate, from a budget perspective, you are in a very favorable position to move forward. So scope and the details of the scope and the task and activities, from schedule and how you are moving forward with the readiness of your legacy systems and your DDI effort and your fit gap analysis and functional design document, and then as we look at your budget, we have a high level of confidence that you are moving in the right direction. In addition, when we take a look at the functionality that has been defined, and we did review a recent audit that was conducted with regard to the Medicaid program, we think that the what we call decision support and program integrity capabilities of the new system will also provide you a return investment in that area as well. That's another additive part of this, of the scope. Strengths, I think strength is the greatest predictive of future behavior is previous behavior. I'm not going to go back to covered Oregon, but I will go to the previous experience you've had with one. That was successful. That was concise. That was tightly managed. And thus, if you continue down that path with the enhancements that you have done, and I place a lot of emphasis on the recommendations that we're about to make moving forward, we believe that that's a great predictor of success for the one IEME program. We did a risk analysis, and there's tremendous detail, and if you're having difficulty getting to sleep tonight, I recommend you read this and all the details. For a program this size, when you take a look at the risk, we identified 28 risk. I, from some of you may have experience in this space, that is a very favorable number of risks for a project of this size and complexity. And then when you look at the high priority risk, high probability, high impact, it's 12. Once again, that is very favorably. Project this size and large should have risk. If it doesn't have risk, then I feel people are hiding things. But when we look at the risk and we categorize the risk from high, medium, to low, and for each of these, by the way, we have provided recommended mitigation strategies that have been accepted by the team. But we look at process risk, 16 risk are there. And by process, we're really talking about things like resource contention. You need to have your subject matter experts for TANF and SNAP that work out in the counties ready and available to do user acceptance testing, ready and available to support deployment, ready and available for training. That risk is how are you scheduling your resources far enough ahead that if you need 15 TANF SMEs on August 15th, they know about it today, so they can do contingency plan to cover how am I going to back up those staff when they go to do UAT or training or whatever. So a lot of these process risks are all around integration of schedule, resource contention, and integration approach to risk. The other is people risk. Do you have the right people at the right time? And this is about how do we enhance their ability to manage the project. And then product risk is really the .NET transfer system that you're bringing in. And there we saw about 6 risk. Again, I cannot overstate the reality here that these number of risk, especially high priority risk, for a project that's pushing the threshold of $300 million, is remarkable considering where you have come from since 2012 and 2013. That's a 180-degree change. I seldom in my 50 years have seen such a turnaround. And it's something to reflect on, that something's going on in this state that's right to make that kind of 180-degree turn possible on something this large and this complex. When we boil down all of the recommendations, they really come down to two pillars for success. If you're going to focus on only two things through your legislative oversight responsibility, and for Tony and his team on they managing this program, the first thing that needs to be looked at is integration. How do you make sure that all of the projects and initiatives that are underway, whether it's the eligibility transformation effort, whether it's the DDI effort, the legacy readiness effort, all the things around data conversion and data quality, around training, around deployment planning, all of the projects and initiatives that are going on need to be integrated under what we call a program office, a program management office, driven by the business. You're moving forward now to have a 360-degree view of your consumers, to prevent duplication and waste, to be in a position where you're empowering folks to be self-caring, self-sufficient, self-responsible. And the whole idea of integrated eligibility is the empowerment of the consumer to have access to the information they need, the service they need, so they can have better outcomes, lower long-term reliance on government support, that there is a lower cost in the assessment and delivery of services, and an increase in quality, customer satisfaction, and an accountability program integrity, that you're doing the right thing at the right time for the right people. That means you need to have this driven by the business. Right now, the eligibility transformation effort is not within the which you call now a project office, and we're recommending you call it a program office, and you bring all those together so you have an integrated work plan, you have integrated risk registry, you have integrated resource allocation, You have integrated issues, that you're managing this as a well-oiled integration of all the initiative activities and projects that are necessary to have this successful trajectory continue to deployment in 2020. Because I will say from here forward, there are going to be more issues and problems that need to be addressed. And the better way to address them is have all of the individuals that are responsible for the transformation of this business through technology enablement part of that program. That will include rethinking a little bit of your joint governance body. Who should be part of that joint governance body? How should that be led if we're really making this a business-driven initiative moving forward and making sure all of these moving parts are coming together? And I know that often we talk about this transformation in health and human services, and I call them silo-centric. For 50 years, they've been run that way. And then I get pushback from people in the business who say, well, no, we're cylinders of excellence. And for me, yeah, okay. But, you know, it's like having 15 lawnmowers, each with their own cylinder, trying to cut the same lawn. How about getting those cylinders in excellence in a V8 engine, working together to do the same thing, to move in the right direction for consumer empowerment and self-sufficiency? So that's what the program is about, getting all those cylinders together, running in a synchronized way to make the success of one IEME possible. The second pillar for success that we think is critically important is to manage your contract and manage your vendor in a very robust manner. Your contract with your systems integrator is very good. It is not to exceed statement of work, fixed price deliverable contract. Much better than a time and material, no deliverables being defined. But that means that you're really going to have to manage that contract and make sure that you lead the statement of work, not the vendor. That means that you're going to have robust deliverable expectation documents for every deliverable that that vendor is going to provide. And thus, through integration and through very disciplined and focused contract and vendor management, all of the risk that we've identified and the recommendations that we're bringing forward can be well managed. So keep in mind those two pillars: integration in every area possible of the program to achieve success for the business, for the program, for the empowerment of the consumers you serve, and manage the vendor. Don't become vendor dependent. manage the vendor, and manage the contract. Recommendations. We see these recommendations pretty much in priority order. Number one is go forward. Do good. Partner with your DDI vendor. We saw no red flags. We saw no barriers. We saw nothing in what we looked at that says you should not move forward. Now, we worked in another state in the past year where we actually said to the governor, stop. Don't spend another nickel. Don't move forward. You need to rethink what you're doing. None of that exists in this state. Secondly, I already talked about it, a program management office. I think you need to rethink and restructure how you're managing this from a program perspective. The joint governance group and the execution group, which is the leaders of all of the different projects that are important to the One IEME initiative, and strong vendor management and performance metrics, including the statements of works that will be defined as the DDI vendor moves forward, and the deliverable expectation document. No deliverable should start until the deliverable expectation document is approved by the state. And it has all of the information necessary of what the state is responsible for, what the vendor is responsible for, and what is the acceptance criteria for that deliverable, the performance criteria for that deliverable. That should be done up front before any work happens on a deliverable. Four, you need to focus, especially since you're not retiring all of your legacy systems, you need to move forward and making sure that data quality and data conversion issues are addressed. You have SNAP and you have TANF and you have childcare. You have all of those individual programs with all the different databases, and now you're going to roll this all out at once in the two pilot J counties. And if there is any data quality or data conversion in any of those programs as you move forward with legacy readiness, people could go without benefits. It could be a real blip. So data quality and data conversion are going to be very important things to attend to. We believe your team are attending to that, but we see this as one of those risk areas as you move forward. So it is an important recommendation. It's number four, not number one, but that's something that needs to be kept in mind. The legacy systems that you aren't going to replace by the One IEME solution, you need to be looking at how do you, as you go forward with the deployment of the new solution, how do you start thinking about modernizing those legacy systems, wrapping them within the new solution? Pace layering is one approach, eventually retiring them. You want to lower your maintenance and operation cost on into the future. So you're on the right path right now with legacy readiness, and you're on the right path right now for One IEME solution. Now, when you get it fully deployed and you have these legacy systems that are still going to be part of this suite, what do you need to be doing to start to lowering their footprint and lowering the cost of maintenance and operation of those legacy systems as you continue to mature the One IEME? That may be a bit outside of our scope, but it's something that you need to be thinking about now as you're moving forward. And lastly is the M&O strategy, which is really connected to the modernization as well as the legacy suite, but it's also around the One IEME solution is based upon .NET technology. Deloitte for decades have used J2E or Java technology. You're in a good place that the .NET technology resources to be able to work in that technical environment are readily available or could be readily available within the state. So as you think about the future, how do you lessen vendor dependency and the costly approach to having the DDI vendor do M&O going forward? What are some of the options about having the state do M&O or local vendors who can work in a .NET environment do M&O? Some things you will probably need Deloitte to continue to do, but you need to now start thinking about the strategy so you're not vendor dependency for the next decade on your DDI vendor to maintain the solution. That as you move to deployment, you're starting to do it in a shoulder-to-shoulder way with some of your own .NET resources to be able to know that system and either continue to maintain it at some level themselves or know how to do the procurement necessary to bring in those resources that then can support the M&O going forward once full deployment has been achieved. And that's the summary. of the assessment. Bottom line is, go forward. You're in the right direction. You got the right team. Your scope, schedule, and budget are favorably disposed to success.
Thank you very much for your report. Are there questions? Yes, Representative.
So the one that concerns me is the number four, the reducing the data quality risk impact, especially one of the ways that we've been successful before on other software projects is to tackle the data issue very early and get a handle on that early. And so we're kind of into this project a little ways there. And it wasn't clear to me earlier, but I think you kind of made it clear. The data that we're talking about here is not the core data that the Magi Medicaid part of it uses. It's just the new DHS stuff. It'd be stuff having to do with TANF and those other DHS kind of programs then. So that risk, I hope that you have that flagged appropriately high, and that's one of your six high risk items there or something, because that's the kind of thing that concerns me. So you can just comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's greater detail in the full report about what we're pointing to. It also includes the crosswalk between the Magi data that you have, because many of the consumers of TANF and SNAP are also consumers there. So there's a certain harmonization or cleansing that will need to be done, and what you have in your client index in the new solution, the one solution that will be in the one IEME solution, and where there may be outliers in the data tables that you have for TANF or SNAP. So, yes, please do look at the report, and there are details there.
Good. Thank you.
I'd like to make a comment. Others may have additional comments and questions. I remember being in this hearing room and hearing a presentation many meetings ago when if things were proving to be very challenging, and I had been pushing really hard that we needed to do something like this, and it looked like it was just going to be darn near impossible, it was going to be too much, and then this new approach was presented to us about adopting the Kentucky model. Yep. And that was the turning point for us, and that was just quite a meeting when that was presented to us. So I'm glad to hear that it turned out that probably was the most significant thing that we did. We changed course and said there's a better way.
Yes. Having been asked in the past here with some of your folks during the covered Oregon days, because we worked on several Oracle environments, Vermont and two of them in Hawaii, the Health Insurance Exchange and also the Integrated Eligibility for the Department of Human Services. So some folks who are no longer here had solicited our input. And the first thing that we really said, because there has been great success in Hawaii DHS around the Oracle stack, it wasn't a technology. It really was truly not understanding what it is you wanted, and that you went forward with a time and materials contract without a really defined milestone or deliverables.
Yeah.
As you look at post-ACA, post the Affordable Care Act, we think if you had made a different decision about a transfer system that was pre-ACA, like the former NextGen system of Deloitte or the Accenture platform or Curum, we probably would not have the findings we have now. You made the decision to go post-ACA solution, the one that Deloitte has done, that's .NET, and at a time when Kentucky was still very favorably disposed to a very person-centered approach to health and human services. So you, whether by luck or real discipline, you definitely made the right decision on that transfer.
It took some talent, and it probably took some nerve on the part of several staff people to tell us we've changed our mind about what we think we ought to be doing. I can appreciate that's difficult to say. I think I haven't been doing this right for a while, and we have figured out there's a better way, and we want to tell you about it. That probably takes some strength of character to do that, and it's serving Oregon well. So I appreciate everyone who was involved at the time, figuring it out. The second point I wanted to make is you made a comment about aligning business practices, that it's not just about the software code or who's inputting data where, it's about business practices. There was another department, not one of these, where the department head had told me about the acronym TWADI. That's the way we've always done it.
That's right. Or WEBE. WEBE here long after you be gone.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Yeah. I appreciated your raising that topic. So it seems like what you're telling us is that we do have people who are prepared to recognize just because we've been doing this way doesn't mean we still have to do it, that we can take advantage of not only technology, but why were we doing that? Do we even need to do that anymore? Or there's something else that's really more important. So that is what's happening, is what I'm getting from what you said.
Absolutely. In fact, I remember one of the interviews, we were questioning the eligibility transformation, maybe very pointedly, because that's my background, is in this whole person-centric model of practice. And one of your leaders on the business side, on the program policy side, you know, we've always wanted to do it this way. We wanted to have this approach to the delivery of services, but we were never able to quite pull it off. And now, bringing in the Benefied solution and the fit gap analysis and the functional design gap, it fits to what we had already been thinking about. The other thing that is critical, of the 17 forensic assessments that we have done on troubled or failed projects, not one of them was in trouble or at a failure mode because of the technology. Not a single one. There were typically the following reasons. Number one is that the solution was not aligned with how they wanted to do the business. And thus they spent, and one state started out with $200 million, now they're up to $500 million doing workarounds of a solution they bought that wasn't aligned to their business. The second thing that was critical to some of these is the chief executives of the organization weren't really on board and championing it. And thus they weren't allocating the resources or providing the attention necessary when the project hit some bumps in the road. One of those failures, I talked to the secretary of the agency who I've known for 20 years. And I said, how did this happen? And he says, well, Frank, I wasn't involved until we had all these problems. And I didn't say this to him, but I want to say, how would you spend $200 million and not be involved? How could you do that? And that's why we place great emphasis on this concept of governance, on the concept of program office, on the concept of the executives need to own this. And they need to be aware of the high risk, not get scared by them or lose their cool. In fact, if they don't see the risk, they should probably say, what's going wrong? Because I need to see the high risk, high probability and high impact. And Tony, how are you mitigating them? They should not wait until there's problems. I was in a state recently about some of the challenges they have. And there was a commissioner said, how did they ever get to the point, and this one state had $300 million and they had to close the project. How did they get $300 million? Didn't they know they had a problem at $30 million or $100 million? In the reality, they didn't. The project was managed and decisions were being made by middle managers. And the head of that agency did not really get involved. This is an IT project. Well, no, it's not an IT project. It's a business transformation project. Yeah. And thus, DHS, especially at this side of the equation now with the one IEME, needs to be very actively involved at the highest level. And then OHA has to be there as the one gets integrated into this single solution. And so your executives, I believe, have to have tremendous ownership of this program along with their program and policy people. You shouldn't spend a nickel on IT or on any IT staff if it's not providing you a return on investment for the program and the policies that you're about for human services.
And that's a quote to write down.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Additional comments? Yes.
Just an overall question. In your slides and in your presentation, you refer to this $360 million as being at the low end of the scale. And in this narrative, you just mentioned a 500 out there and a, you know.
Oh, yes.
These numbers are mind-boggling. This is the state of Oregon, a measly, sorry, Oregonians, a measly 4 million people, and we're talking budgets, you know, like this. Across all 50 states, multiply that times 50, and we have, you know, each state becomes a siloed or a cylinder of excellence, right? You know, and yet this entire schedule runs out to 2020.
Correct.
What's the total cost projection there, and what are the large, you know, bullet holes across the nation? Healthcare is, quite frankly, run amok, and we're doing our best to configure eligibility requirements and whatever thing. But this healthcare is going to be the feature that eats the U.S. economy if we don't wrap these things up in nice, tight bundles.
You're very accurate. I mean, a state of 625,000 people will spend $300 million. Some of the outliers like California, New York may will spend more, but basically that you're in that range. In the full report, we do provide, without naming the states, comparables that you should look at. The other thing that's important, and was part of the previous presentation with the environmental management system, you need to be looking to interoperability, modularity, and reusability. How many different portals do you need? How many different master data management do you need? How many rules engines do you need? It's very important as you invest this kind of money, you're purchasing components that can be reused. For example, in one state where we worked with them for integrated eligibility about a rules engine and an enterprise master person index and an identity access management set of capability and a service bus for health and human services for the integrated eligibility. They're now using that with the Department of Motor Vehicles for identity access management, enterprise master person index. Buy it once, use it many times. And that's something that I know your CIO is very much aware of, so that you're gaining a magnitude of economies if you're going to spend this kind of money. The .NET environment is a good example. .NET is .NET. Some pieces of it are agnostic. They don't care if it's the motor vehicle department or forestry or the library. It's pretty agnostic. Some things are tailored, obviously, to specific needs of a program, as you will have with SNAP or Medicaid or child welfare. But some of the common components are things that you should be looking at with this solution around reusability.
Anything else? Sounds like a wonderful opportunity for us to use the best ideas of all of our people at the Health Authority and Human Services to unleash creativity and enthusiasm and skills for building something for the future. Thank you for the report, and we'll keep reading. Mr. Cummings, what do you have for us?
Co-Chair Nathans, members of the committee. Based upon the LFO's analysis and review of the IE project's evidence that the project is back on track and ready to proceed, LFO recommends that the JCLIMT acknowledge receipt of the joint agency report, adopt LFO's detailed recommendations to the agency as contained within the detailed LFO analysis posted on OLIS, and recommend that the agency be allowed to proceed with the one IE and ME project consistent with their revised baseline scope, schedule, and budget estimates, with the expectation that the project will be asking for $143.8 million in additional funding during the 2019 legislative session.
Any questions about LFO's report? Is there a motion to accept the recommendation?
I move to accept the recommendation as presented by LFO.
Thank you. Discussion on the motion? Objections? Motion passes. Another big milestone. Well, despite all of the flowery remarks, everyone who's working on this, look at all the watchdogs you have. People are watching, and
seven levels of oversight.
My goodness. And thank you all for all of your work and for being here. Do we have any other business?
Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, that's our last item for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for next Friday, February 23rd.
Okay. We're adjourned.
Thank you.